Some things shouldn't be transparent, like stop signs. But what you pay for should always be clear, like Hiller's True Transparency Pricing. Always clearly itemized and never any hidden fees. Because you have the right to know what you're paying for. For more information, visit happyhiller.com/true transparency pricing. Happy you'll be, or the service is free.
Call the Happy Face Truck today.
Day 180, served up by Wendy's with Chad Withrow and Paul Kuharski. I'm Jonathan Hutton. David Reed is the chairman of the board. And every Monday at this time, we say hello to John Feinstein, hitting the national headlines from the weekend. John, always great to talk with you. How are you?
Jonathan, I'm well. Chad, Paul, good to have all three of you together.
Very good. Yes. We're happy to be together finally. Again, we tiptoe into any soccer conversation with you because we know how you start. I'm curious from a broadcasting angle. We've been talking a lot about what Fox has and has not done with this. They paid, I think, $450 million for U.S. rights to two World Cups, and they're doing nothing with the highlights, John. I mean, if you want to see a nice six-minute package on a game that you didn't see, apparently, you have to watch it in Spanish on Telemundo because it's not available on Fox in America.
Well, Paul, you would know that more than I would. You know, I obviously follow the World Cup. I'm not a complete dimwit, especially when it comes to soccer. And when I'm home and I know there are games on, and I know they were on at 8, 11, and 2 for the first, 12 days, and now they're playing the last group matches simultaneously, so that nobody gets an advantage, I guess. So I'm aware of that, and if I'm home and I'll turn on a match and watch. I was in the tank for Iceland early on and was very encouraged by their opening tie, but very discouraged by their defeat. And so I'm really not in a position to tell you with any degree of expertise about Fox's coverage, but I'm not surprised to hear you say that.
What is it about? I mean, Fox routinely, I'm curious what you think about their golf coverage. Chad was saying earlier, he just feels like if something's on Fox that he suspects it's not going to be as good unless it's the NFL, because they haven't shown that they are capable of handling some of these events that they've dived into.
Yeah, I think that there's something to that. I think Chad is right. You know, their first year with the U.S. Open was an unmitigated disaster, highlighted by Holly Saunders' second question to Jordan Spieth after he'd become a U.S. Open champion, being, what would you have done for an outfit tomorrow if there had been a playoff? That was kind of symbolic of their coverage. I think it's improved. And again, because I'm always at the U.S. Open, I don't see that much of the coverage. But there were some moments where I wondered what in the heck Paul Azinger was talking about. At one point, he said something after Ian Poulter made a triple bogey on, I want to say, late Friday. Azinger said, well, we all know Ian Poulter never chokes, but he just took the apple right there. Huh? I thought they did a decent job with the Mickelson situation. Curtis Strange handled the interview well, I thought, especially as a two-time U.S. Open champion himself. But there's a lack of depth, I guess, is the best way I would describe it. And I think Brad Faxon and Steve Flesch are very solid. And Joe Buck, I know, is a very good golfer, and I think he's one of the best broadcasters in the business. He just feels miscast as a golf broadcaster, to me. Because he hasn't done, you do one event a year, no matter who you are. And I know Buck does other events, but the only one he does that matters is the U.S. Open. You're not going to be as good as if you do 15 or 20 events a year. Now, let me say one other thing. I know I'm long-winded here, but CBS always gets all these kudos for their golf coverage. I think it's vastly overrated. I really do. I mean, I was watching Hartford yesterday. If a guy hits the ball out of bounds, Ian Baker Finch, when he's on, will say, well, it was a great swing. It's just unfortunate the ball went out of bounds. Nobody ever hits a bad shot on CBS. Nobody. You know, there's always a reason for it, or it was that, it was so close to being a perfect shot. And I think they've been together too long. They're just too comfortable with themselves. So You know, and again, Golf Channel, where I used to work, again, they've become a see no evil entity too, with rare exceptions. I thought Frank Nabilo and Brandel Chambly handled the Mickelson thing well, but Tim Rosenfort and Jaime Diaz, who are both friends of mine, were falling all over themselves to defend Mickelson in an indefensible position on Saturday night. So I could pick out flaws with just about anybody's golf coverage, I guess is what I'm saying in my long-winded way.
Does your opinion of Phil Mickelson and what happened change a little bit with his admission, even though it was 4 days late, that he just lost his cool?
Not really, Chad. It's a good question. This is sort of typical Phil. He puts his finger in the air after he's involved in a controversy, and if the wind's blowing against him, then he'll turn around and say, oh, yeah, I'm sorry, I shouldn't have done it. You remember when he, you know, whined about his tax bill in California a few years ago, and people came down hard on him, and a few days later he showed up at a press conference and apologized, and because, you know, guys make netting $55 million is whining about his taxes. That didn't look good. I think the one thing I'll say is I think he did finally tell the truth, that he did lose it for a second. And if he had said that initially on Saturday afternoon instead of playing I'm the smartest guy in the room, then I think people would have been far more sympathetic, because anybody who's ever played golf at any level can relate to that, to the frustration and the losing it for a moment. And if he had said that, hey, I'm sorry, as we discussed last week, people would have said, yeah, we understand the golf course setup was terrible on Saturday, and he lost it. Poor Phil, two-stroke penalty, move on.
So I'm watching Bubba Watson in his 63 yesterday to win the Travelers, and I'm thinking to myself, it is incredible watching Bubba Watson on certain courses where he can really dominate, and he's won that event now three different times.
Right.
But then you also think about, you know, maybe the unfulfilled potential a little bit of Bubba Watson, because I feel like we get teased by these moments of true greatness with him and sort of the artistic level of his game with how creative he can be.
You know what, Chad? Bubba Watson is just, he is who he is. And you can tell early in almost any week how well Bubba Watson's going to play. I mean, if he comes in for a pre-tournament press conference and starts talking about the difficulty of the golf course and it's really hard and I don't think I want to play here, he's missing the cut. I mean, I remember at Pinehurst at the U.S. Open a few years ago, he came, boy, if we had to play this golf course every week of the year, none of us would want to be professional golfers. He misses the cut. But if he likes a golf course, as you said, if he's comfortable out there with himself and with his game, then he is capable of greatness. And we've seen that. I mean, he's comfortable at Augusta National. He's won twice there. He's not been comfortable on other golf courses at majors and has not won a major on any of the other majors. He came close at the PGA at Whistling Straits in 2010. But you know what? I think this, Chad, you could take almost any golfer who is not Tiger Woods circa 1997 to 2008 or Jack Nicklaus in his prime, and you can pick out weaknesses in their game. Why doesn't Dustin Johnson close better? Why didn't Fred Couples win more? Why can't Rory McIlroy get comfortable with the putter and dominate the way he should be able to with his ball striking? So that's the thing about golf. Everybody has a weakness. Sometimes it's mental, sometimes it's physical, and sometimes it's both.
John, LeBron James says he does not want a circus with his courting. Yeah. Well, is that even possible? I mean, I know he doesn't want a circus around him. You already have cities putting up billboards.
He minimized it last time with Lee Jenkins.
Is he going to be able to pull this off, the no circus with this whole courtship?
He can minimize it, as Paul said. I mean, the first time around was absolutely ridiculous, and he ended up looking bad, and I think he was the victim of very bad advice, to the point where David Stern told me once that he begged the people around LeBron to cool it with the whole decision thing. And they did learn their lesson, as you said, Paul, the second time around, and it was quieter, and he simply went to Lee Jenkins of Sports Illustrated, said, here's the story. Funniest moment of all in that, I don't know if you guys remember this, was ESPN had Chris Broussard on about 2 hours later, after the Lee Jenkins story had broken, saying, I have been able to confirm that LeBron James is returning to Cleveland. Well, he confirmed it by reading Sports Illustrated.
Right.
I mean, that's how ridiculous ESPN can be. But I don't think we're going to have a decision circus. And it really is up to LeBron. You know, he, on the one hand, he says, I don't want a circus, but I'm willing to meet with some owners. I'm willing to meet with some CEOs, GMs, whatever. Well, you know, I don't know why he needs any meetings. I mean, he should be able to look and say, this is who this team is. The money's not a factor. We know that. He's going to be paid a gazillion dollars wherever he plays. I mean, he could opt in to the Cavaliers for $35.6 million today if he wanted to. That would avoid a circus. But if he's going to go and meet with people, it's certainly not going to stay secret, and it is going to become a circus.
John, if you're Cleveland, how do you approach it with him? Because he's already played the storyline of coming back home and playing for his home team again.
And he won him a championship.
Right. So how do you convince him that this is the place he needs to be if you've already tugged on those heartstrings once?
LeBron, what do you want? LeBron, what do you want us to do? Tell us what you want us to do that we can do reasonably to give you the team that you want. And if he says trade Kevin Love, get a new coach, whatever, you do it. And then you can look in the mirror and say we did everything we could, and if it's not good enough, it's not good enough.
John, Jameis Winston in this Uber ride that is the big debate as to who was with him and who wasn't with him. It's come to light that one of the people that was in one of these Ubers with him was Brandon Banks, who we know here because at the time he was facing a charge of rape, and since then he's been convicted of rape at Vanderbilt, a trial that we all followed very closely here. Jameis Winston had at the very least been accused of sexual harassment during his time at FSU, choosing to surround himself with somebody who is about to face a rape trial, probably symbolic of the decision-making qualities that he's had on display.
Yeah, you know, I don't know Jameis Winston except the same way a lot of people do through all these various stories he's been involved with, sexual assault claim, the shoplifting you remember at the Publix when he was still in college, and now this latest incident. People who I trust, one of them being Doug Williams, who's now the player personnel director here in Washington, who keeps tabs on African-American quarterbacks in the NFL because he was the first one to win a Super Bowl and feels a kinship to those guys, and Ryan Fitzpatrick, who's now Winston's backup and who will probably start the three games he's suspended for, and who I worked with last year on this quarterback book, both say good things about him. Two guys who I respect, who I think are very bright, think that he's a bright guy, think that he's got the potential to be a great quarterback at some point, but both will admit there is an immature streak. Now, the question is, where does immaturity leave off and irresponsibility and arrogance and perhaps criminal behavior kick in? And there's a line. I don't know where the line is. It sounded like he skated because the FSU police didn't really want to investigate the sexual assault case from this reporting in the New York Times and other stories. Don't know if that's true. To me, the shoplifting, while not a big deal on the face of itself, shows, is it immaturity? Is it stupidity? Is it arrogance? Is it entitlement? I don't know. But there are a lot of question marks, at the very least, that have been raised around Jameis Winston. And on the one hand, I look at two guys who I think I know well, having worked closely with them, as I said, in the last year on this quarterback book, who I respect, saying he's going to be fine, he's going to be a star, and then all this evidence on the other side saying he's not going to be fine, and his lack of decision making off the field is going to prevent him from being the star that he clearly has the physical skills to become.
It's amazing, John, because the stories you're telling us about with what different people say about Jameis Winston, he seems to me like a guy who just has two extreme sides. It's possible that he's both a guy who loves football, is a great teammate, is a great leader in the locker room, and a guy who just behaves like a complete and utter moron away from the field. It sounds to me like there are just two Jameis Winstons out there.
You're right, Chad. And again, if you watched the Hard Knocks last year, which I did again largely because of Fitzpatrick's involvement, which wasn't major, but he was part of it as Winston's backup, everything you said came across. good teammate, good leader, articulate, guy with clearly the potential to be a great player. And then all these other stories that, of course, were not part of Hard Knocks, because let's remember that Hard Knocks is NFL controlled, come out, and you go, what the blank is this guy thinking? I mean, what is he doing? Again, it's baffling, I'd say, more than anything. Because when it was happening at Florida State, again, there's no excuse for sexually assaulting someone if he in fact did that. But the shoplifting thing could just be immaturity, growing up, being entitled, as I said. I mean, he won the Heisman Trophy, was he a redshirt freshman or a sophomore? I forget, but it was in his second year in college. So a lot came quickly, but now, you know, he's going into his fourth year in the NFL. It's time to kind of man up as a person.
Let's talk about another Heisman Trophy winner, Baker Mayfield. Did you happen to see the exchange with him and Colin Cowherd last week?
Did not. I don't watch any of those shows.
Well, the transcript is fantastic.
So essentially,
really? Well,
Baker Mayfield.
I'll go look it up on your recommendation, Paul.
Well, it's not often that you see a very young athlete like him handle himself in a way that makes the radio host look really bad.
Mm.
And it was a really interesting exchange, but basically centered around the thought that Colin Cowherd believes he's immature. And that he's a me first guy, and he pointed to film of him celebrating with his band and with his cheering section at Ohio State instead of going with his teammates. And Baker Mayfield points out, well, I celebrated with my teammates every other time. You picked one clip where I ran to our fans and then ran to our sideline to try to make your point. So, I mean, it was an interesting exchange. Check it out if you get a chance. But
right.
Just curious of your thoughts.
Wasn't that the night, that he behaved badly at the end of the game after they won?
That's when he put the Oklahoma flag
right
at midfield.
Right. So he was wired that night. And, you know, I've seen guys run to their band or their cheerleaders or whatever in moments of celebration. I don't think that's a big deal. There have been some other incidents. I thought the Kansas incident, to me, was the one that was most stunning. I mean, they're playing Kansas. They're winning by a million because they're playing Kansas. And he's screaming profanities at the Kansas bench and the Kansas players. That's the one that's most baffling to me. Winning a game at Ohio State, I can see where that would cause an emotional reaction. But you're playing Kansas and you're losing your mind? That would concern me if I were the Cleveland Browns.
John, when was the last time that you were really into the NBA draft?
Really into the NBA
draft? You look forward to sitting down to watch the NBA draft.
Probably never, Jonathan. I don't really get into watching drafts because nothing, you know, I mean, I want to know the outcome ultimately. But especially in the last few years when the NFL draft and the NBA draft have just become kind of infomercials for the league. You know, where every guy who gets drafted is a great guy, and it's nothing but a parade of, you know, everything is wonderful. But I've always, when it comes to stuff like that where there's no game to watch or something, I usually, you know, in the old days I would wait till the newspaper came out in the morning. Nowadays I just go online. Thursday night I had a speaking commitment up in Hartford, so I came in when it was over, went online, saw who'd gotten drafted, and went to bed.
My interest level goes down each year. I feel like if on the scale of what I want to watch, and I'm kind of like you. Like I DVR'd the draft, watched the first pick, and then quickly fast forwarded through the next 4 hours and hit delete. Like I didn't even care to watch as the picks came off.
The NFL's really turned it into an event, like a can't miss TV for its fans, and the NBA seems to have failed totally in terms of matching that.
Well, first of all, you can't. I mean, the NFL, for all of its issues the last few years and all of its TV ratings drops, Paul, is still king of the hill. And people will, you know, and they have created this notion that it's a major event, even though, to me, it's just a list of players. And, you know, I think I saw an internet headline the other day featuring the fashion decisions of the NBA players at the draft. I mean, really? Really, we care about that now? But I'm an old curmudgeon. You guys know that. And I just want to know the names. I want to know who got drafted. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't intriguing moments. I thought the Dallas-Atlanta swap with Dallas wanting Doncic as a big point guard and Atlanta wanting Trae Young as a little point guard, I thought that was intriguing. that each team basically put itself out there. Dallas giving potentially a number one pick next year because they want Doncic, they want the big point guard. And Atlanta saying, you know, we think Trae Young reminds us of Stephen Curry, so we'll take a chance here. That was intriguing. All the quarterbacks who went quickly in the NFL draft this year, that was intriguing. And Josh Rosen's reaction to quote unquote dropping to 10. And then from my point of view, because I was working with Joe Flacco on this same quarterback book, when the Ravens took Lamar Jackson at the end of the first round, that was very interesting. But in terms of what's said on the air, I can watch on mute for both of them.
Well, and John, I'm not sure how much these guys playing 1 year of college basketball is helping the overall name recognition of some of the players.
Because there's
a lot of guys who just weren't that famous in college basketball that played 1 year, that didn't really contribute a lot, that are high draft picks.
Or Europeans that we don't
and
know.
And so are Europeans.
Yeah.
You know, I've read about Doncic, but I've never seen him play. I know there are highlights available, but I've never seen the guy play a basketball game. So I don't know anything about it. But your point is very well taken, Chad. I think one of the things the one and done rule has done is that it used to be that kids would stay 3-4 years most of the time. So that, for example, when Grant Hill graduated from Duke, having been in the Final Four 3 years out of four, people felt like he was a member of their family by the time he got drafted. And that was true of a lot of star players in college in the 70s, 80s, 90s. I remember, and this will show my age, but when Lou Alcindor came into the NBA in 1969 and when Pete Maravich came into the NBA the next year, their arrival was such a big deal that ABC, which didn't start televising NBA games till January, had their debuts on national television. That's back when being on national television was a huge deal. That doesn't happen anymore because almost nobody comes into the NBA. We know who they are. We've seen them play. They've been promoted and all that stuff. But it's not like anybody has any great feelings for DeAndre Ayton or Marvin Bagley. They played 1 year of college ball. And by the way, neither one won anything. So great talents, I guess, but does anybody really care?
John Feinstein, every Monday with us. John, thank you as always. We'll do it again next week.
Look forward to it, guys. Thanks a lot.
John Feinstein at J Feinstein Books on Twitter.